Welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm John Tanza, working on this pre-recorded program very more. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, August 18, 2021. A member of South Sudan's holdout rebel group says the South Sudan Movement Alliance is committed to a peaceful resolution of the conflict in South Sudan. And a member of a civil society coalition says South Sudanese should be involved in efforts to address challenges facing them.
We are operating within the constitution of South Sudan, which gives the people of South Sudan the right to freely assemble, to freely speak their minds about what is going on in the country.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. President Salva Kiir is threatening to withdraw from peace negotiations with the South Sudan Opposition Movements Alliance, an umbrella group that refused to sign the 2018 peace agreement. President Kiir blamed the holdout group for attacks and killings along the Juba-Nimule Highway on Monday. The Secretary for Information and Public Relations in the South Sudan Movement Alliance, Kwaje Lasso, denies his group had anything to do with the attack on the Juba-Nimule Highway. Kwaje blames the government of President Salva Kiir for not doing enough to stop road ambushes along the road linking Juba and Uganda.
It is unfortunate. It's something that is tragic. We strongly denounce it. It should not be the case. We really extend our profound condolences, thoughts, and prayers to the entire Catholic world, and more specifically to the families of the two nuns, Mary Abud and Sister Regina Roba, as well as our condolences to His Grace, the Archbishop Stephen Amayo of Juba Metro Pelton Archdiocese. Equally the same, also, Soma, we extend our condolence to those other members who are the victims who have lost their life in this tragic event. It's profoundly a sad event for the people of South Sudan, the religious fraternity at large. We strongly condemn this barbaric attack and cowardly attack on this civilian that has been going on for some time across South Sudan.
This is a high-profile event. It happened just a few miles away from Juba, a day after President Kiir himself traveled that road to attend the centenary of the lower parish. Yesterday, we reported that at least five people were killed, including two nuns from the Sacred Heart parish. President Kiir put it squarely on your group. He says you are responsible for it. Now, who did it?
That is a very good question. You know, this is an important event that has taken place in Loa and is attended by high-profile leaders of the country, including the president and the vice president. One would think that that route is completely well-secured and well-protected. But unfortunately, those nuns and those who are traveling in that route fell into this ambush. And we, in some categorically blame the government of South Sudan for this incident. We've been President Kiir has categorically trying to point the fingers as a holdout group, which is derogatory name calling for the opposition group. But we strongly denounce it. We have no any presence in the area by all means possible. Fortunately, this is falling squarely in the hands of the Juba regime. And in fact, history, if anything, evidence in the past have shown members of the SSPDF, South Sudan People Defense Forces, have been culprits in such incidents. There's a reason, because these people who serve in the country or security of the country has not been paid for a long time, and they resorted to banditry by attacking people, looting people's property. And we strongly believe that it's an internal incident perpetrated by Kiir and Kiir regime and his military force.
But you are the only armed groups that are not part of the government and are not part of the peace process. So the fingers of blame automatically turn to you.
It's very unfortunate. But the question is, which peace agreement are we talking about? The peace in South Sudan, Juba, that there's no peace. This is the agreement is collapsed. It's just a matter of time need to be buried. But in reality, there's no peace agreement. And in fact, for us being not be part of the agreement, it's very abundantly clear. We put our statement very clear out there. We are against the agreement. But to put the record straight, we still engage with the government of South Sudan talks in Rome under auspices of this community of San Egidio, and we are committed to the process. But unfortunately, throughout the process, Juba has been abrogating our initial agreement that we signed, for example, secession of hostility. Juba have attacked our position numerous times in the past, and that's something. It's not something new. But to your point, yes, we squarely blame Juba as the culprit because this is happening in their watchful eyes. We don't have any presence in that specific location. And in fact, the Aru Junction, this is a suburb of Juba. This is very close to Juba. If we are functioning in Aru Junction, we would be walking to Juba any time. But this is not the case where we don't have any presence in the area.
The South Sudan Opposition Movements Alliance is not one group. It is an umbrella of four armed groups with no one unified command. So how can you say confidently that no elements from the group committed these atrocities?
That is not accurate. Soma, we function under one umbrella and with a coordinated effort as we speak. Therefore, we have semi-coordinated unified command.
Now, this is not the first time attacks on civilians happen where your group and the government trade accusations and counter-accusations. People are fed up with this game. What can you tell them that they have not heard before? How can you assure them? This is not just business as usual.
Well, the evidence speaks a volume. Unfortunately, people are become victims of this ongoing crisis in the country. It's very sad. We hope that should not be the case. We stand and speak for the people, and we will be the last to inflict injuries or any atrocity among the civilians. But unfortunately, if you can see today, the situation under the regime of Kiir is in total collapse and failing miserably. In fact, it's Kiir himself is perpetuating all the this killing in the country because it is a policy of diverting attention of the people by creating insecurity all over the country in order to solidify his claim to power.
How is this going to affect negotiations between Soma and the government in the future and their own process in general?
I can tell you categorically, we in Soma, we committed to this negotiation. We believe in a peaceful resolution of the conflict in our country. We want to see the country and our people live in freedom. And what we fought for the last 20 years and why what we fought for to be an independent country. But it is very unfortunate. It's very reckless and irresponsible from President Kiir to utter anything as such that withdrawing from Rome peace process is a threat. But that threat, I believe it is a pretext into what they intend to do because our intel are telling us Juba is preparing to attack our positions as we speak.
That's Kwajja Lasu, Secretary for Information and Public Relations at the South Sudan Movement Alliance. He was speaking with my colleague Nabil Biagio from the U.S. state of North Carolina earlier today. The group calling itself the People's Coalition for Civil Action have set August 30th as a day for South Sudanese to protest the living conditions across the country. Abraham Akech Awolich is a member of the coalition. He says his group is prepared to participate in a peaceful protest on August 30th.
We are operating within the constitution of South Sudan, which gives the people of South Sudan the right to freely assemble, to freely speak their minds about what is going on in the country. We are preparing, we are building teams, we are reaching out to groups, and we are planting cells for people to come out and clarifying why they should be coming out.
Several statements from the coalition have been signed by 2 to 3 members. In my conversation with you right now, you are using the word we. We. Who are you with?
We are working with the people of South Sudan. Obviously, this is not a private company. This is a public interest group that is mobilizing the people of South Sudan to rise up and to demand their rights. So we are working with a lot of people. inside South Sudan and outside the country. And obviously, whatever we are doing is for the majority of the people of South Sudan. That's why we keep making reference to we. The coalition is not for those who have signed the declaration. It is for those whose interests we are advocating for.
I've been following developments with this coalition for quite a long time and reading every statement that you issue. And one thing that caught my eye in your latest statement was that you are proposing a 4,000% increase in the salaries of civil servants. That sounds like unrealistic demand.
Not at all. We are looking at the salaries of soldiers. For example, if a soldier now makes 1,200, in the current exchange rate, you are talking about $2 or $1.50. And so what we want to do, if we increase that by 4,000%, it will be about £48,000. That is just about $50 a month. That is not too much to ask for, isn't it?
You seem to be targeting the soldiers here, asking the government to pay soldiers your proposed 4,000% increase. Why soldiers when everybody in the country is suffering?
We are not talking about soldiers being paid that. I was just giving you an example. We are saying all the salaries of civil servants should be increased by 4,000%. And that is what would be the livable wage given the current market in South Sudan. If you pay, for example, in the ministries, there are people called messengers. Messengers almost make the same amount as soldiers. The bare minimum amount they need to survive is about £50,000 per month.
Abraham, you sound like you are trying to entice the people of South Sudan using their conditions so that they can come out on the streets to protest. But you are making these demands in a country that is cash-trapped. Where is the government going to get that amount of money to pay its huge workforce?
You have to remember, we are an oil-producing state, and oil is still flowing in South Sudan. And to ask for ordinary citizens of South Sudan to be paid a minimum of $50 is not something that is too much, and it is not beyond the capacity of the government to afford. We do have resources. They are just misallocated. And so, for example, we are currently building a road that is going to cost us $2 billion, and 1 kilometer is $5 million. Do we need that road really if our people cannot afford food? Why don't we redirect that money to serve the basic needs of people first?
Your coalition, since its inception, has been issuing statements, if you like, every week or every 2-3 days. What makes you different from other holdout groups who have done nothing but just writing statements from foreign capitals?
Well, we have never seen a group of people writing and issuing statements saying that we want the people of South Sudan to rise up to follow their rights. All these other groups, except the Red Card movement, which had been asking people to rise up. We are different. We have a strong organization on the ground. We live among our people. That will make us very different. And we are also non-violent. We are not asking anybody to throw a stone at anyone or at any material.
Abraham, it's a common knowledge that the only protest or demonstration allowed on the streets of South Sudan is either a government state-managed demonstration. Why are you encouraging people to go on the streets when you know that any protest against the government will be met with brutality?
The other option is to make our people slaves. If they want to be slaves in their own country, then they should fear. But if they want to be free and first-class citizens, this is their right to come out and demonstrate. And obviously the government will scare them. But if they actually come out of the street, the government will not shoot them. They know what the consequences are. We can hold them accountable, and they will be taken to the Hague. They know that it is crime against international law to kill or to brutalize peaceful demonstrators.
Abraham, are you going to be part of this protest or demonstrations on the streets of Juba or on the streets of wherever you are?
Obviously, I'm the one organizing this, so with my colleagues, so we will be there. Nobody organizes something that they are not part of. Absolutely, I'm assuring you that. I will be on the street somewhere in South Sudan. It doesn't have to be in Juba. It could be in Juba, it could be in Ye, or it could be in Reng, but I will be somewhere on the streets in South Sudan.
That's Abraham Akech Awolich, member of the People's Coalition for Civil Action. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, Uganda accepts to host 2,000 Afghan refugees. Find out why after the break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how can you promote tourism within your country amongst your fellow citizens?
By sponsoring or organizing trips for schools and others, because there are some people who don't have money to go to such places.
Telling people about how our culture and history is, through that I can promote.
By having friendly activities available, like affordable costs of travel, food and accommodation.
Maybe by posting on the social media about the tourism activities happening in the country, as well as the places that people can visit. Places I know, such as some in Mangochi, maybe in Mulanje, by putting that on the social media.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Uganda has agreed to temporarily host 2,000 Afghan refugees at the request of the United States. For VOA News, Alima Athumani reports from Kampala.
Esther Anyakun, Uganda's State Minister for Relief, Disaster Preparedness and Refugees, says President Yoweri Museveni told her to make preparations to host 2,000 refugees from Afghanistan. She says Uganda acted at the request of the United States government.
They requested us to host 2,000 refugees. We're expecting them to be brought in shifts of 500. So UNHCR secured Imperial Hotels in Entebbe as transit center for them to first of all arrive and be screened.
UN High Commission for Refugees Uganda representative Joel Botro also confirms the decision to receive the Afghan refugees.
We welcome that, of course, and again, the generosity of the Ugandan government. And what we're doing is we're preparing in terms of with the Office of the Prime Minister receiving them at the airport, lodging them, and then there will be all this screening, testing, and then we'll see for the next steps, depending on what... For example, the Ugandan government and maybe also other governments, in particular the U.S. government, want to do if ever they want to help resettle them.
Thousands of Afghans are fleeing the country after Taliban fighters announced Sunday they had entered Kabul and took control of the presidential palace. President Ashraf Ghani left Afghanistan, reportedly saying he wanted to avoid bloodshed, signaling the end of a 20-year conflict. The Taliban fighters declared the war in Afghanistan over, prompting tens of thousands to flee the fighters' hardline Islamist rule. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Still in Uganda, Uganda's health ministry has confirmed the outbreak of polio in the country after samples collected from sewage plants in Bogolobi tested positive. The ministry says the resurgence of polio in Uganda may be attributed to reduced routine polio immunization in the country during the COVID-19 pandemic, as well as across border movement among the neighboring countries, including South Sudan. A senior public relations officer at Uganda's Ministry of Health says the ministry has increased polio surveillance and will conduct a nationwide polio immunization in October and December.
The Ministry of Health in Uganda has declared a polio public health emergency following laboratory test confirmation obtained from environmental samples in Kampala. The samples were obtained from Sentinel surveillance points at Rubiji and Bugorobi sewage plants. These samples were taken to the Uganda Virus Research Institute, where they confirmed presence of the circulating vaccine-derived polio virus type 2. This is similar to what has been reported in nearby Sudan.
What do you mean by vaccine-derived polio?
When children are immunized with oral polio vaccine, the weakened vaccine virus replicates in the intestines for a limited period of time, thereby activating immunity for this child. And at the same time, the body excretes this vaccine virus through the fecal route and thereby confirming this presence of the circulating poliovirus, a strain that has been detected in the sewerage in Kampala.
You said resurgence of polio in Uganda may be due to reduced routine polio immunization in Uganda. Can you elaborate?
Yes, James. Because of the COVID-19 pandemic, we suspect that a number of parents have not been able to access the vaccination due to the concentration on the coronavirus. However, as you may recall, Uganda was declared free of the world polio virus in August of 2020. But as you may note, about 19 African countries have since reported this specific type of the circulating vaccine-derived poliovirus. So we suspect it has been imported through movements, and also this could be as a result of a decline in vaccination.
What is the Ministry of Health doing to respond to this latest outbreak?
Yeah, James, in response to this polio outbreak, the Ministry of Health in Uganda has intensified surveillance and also the search for cases, and also ensuring that investigations happen for all cases of paralysis amongst children below 15 years of age. In addition, the Ministry of Health in Uganda intends to conduct a house-to-house vaccination exercise, and this is tentatively slated to happen in October and December this year.
That's Emmanuel Anyibonya, a senior public relations officer at the Uganda's Ministry of Health. He spoke with my colleague James Batty from the capital, Kampala. And now for some climate news. Thanks to carbon emission, our oceans are turning to acids, is dissolving the shells of oysters and attacking global shorelines, damaging ecosystems that suck more carbon dioxide from the ocean waters than all the world's vehicles spew in the air. In this first report of the series, Cost versus Climate, VOA's Veronica Valdaras Iglesias explores the evil twin of climate change and how to remedy it.
Inside a mesh bag on Virginia's eastern shore is a gurgling answer to climate change. Scientists submerged oysters in a bed of seagrass, an experiment to see if underwater plants, which naturally absorb carbon dioxide, can protect them. You see, oceans are turning warmer and more acidic, thanks to humans burning fossil fuels. And this is hurting not just oysters, but the bountiful ecosystems around them. Michael Oppenheimer is a review editor at the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
Acidification occurs because the carbon dioxide we're adding to the atmosphere dissolves partly in the ocean and forms a weak acid. Any shell-forming creature has a more difficult job forming its shell in an ocean that's more acidic.
At stake is the destructive impact on marine life and the delicate food chains that sustain the world's fisheries. Take creatures called theropods. These tiny sea snails populate all the world's oceans and are a precious food for salmon and many important fish. But in acidic ocean waters, their shells dissolve. Scientists are studying ocean acidification, often called climate change's evil twin. At the Virginia Institute of Marine Science, Professor Emily Rivest runs experiments on oysters.
We have that combination of warming and acidification. We see the most dramatic negative effects on the larvae. So they don't form their shell properly, and they don't eat as well.
The experiments help aquaculture in the Chesapeake Bay. The massive estuary suffers from coastal acidification, caused in part by heavy rains and fertilizer runoff. Michael Congrove owns a commercial oyster hatchery.
Where it becomes really tricky is when we have periods of poor water quality that we're not able to solve with our filtration solutions, and that can really put a dent in our production.
If these steps fail, oyster farmers like Brandon Eanes are at risk. He buys seed from hatcheries to sell for wholesale distribution.
You put them in these tanks and they grow.
Yes, ma'am. They put them in these tanks until they grow, until they're about half an inch, something big enough that we can put in this bag.
Eanes is skeptical of human-made climate change, but he concedes that something in the past 10 years has shifted.
We have oysters grow in December. That's kind of not normal. They're not growing much, but as it gets warmer, I think, if anything, the calendar's shifted. If climate change is man-made, I would hope that man would be smart enough to stop doing what he's doing to have adverse effects.
At the end of June, a record heat wave had catastrophic effects for shellfish in the Pacific Northwest and Canada. Get used to it, scientists say. And the impacts will go beyond shellfish to marine life critical for tourism, says Michael Oppenheimer of the Intergovernmental Climate Change Panel.
And I've been to places where the health of the corals is clearly diminished, starting with South Florida, parts of the Mexican Yucatan, much of the Caribbean, certainly parts of the Pacific also.
That's all we prepared for you today. Let us know what you think about this show. Our WhatsApp number is +1 202 630 8011. We reserve the right to read your brief comments every Friday. We now leave you with Gordon Kong singing about Sudan. We have been listening to Gordon Kong singing about Sudan. I'm John Tanza. Thanks for being part of our evening. Remember to always wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask when you're in public places to protect you and others from getting COVID-19. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there's no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America.